J.K. Rowling didn't know she was going to be one of the most famous writers in the world. She was just writing a story for her kids. Steve Jobs didn't know he'd be a pioneer of how humanity interacts with technology. He was just a guy in his garage making a computer. Oprah didn't know she'd become the poster woman for self-improvement and success. She was just trying to do a job. You don't need to know what you're doing to still do something extraordinary. 4. There is no way you will be able to predict or plan what will be happening in 5 years from now. 5. If you can predict and plan for that, dream bigger. Try harder. 6. Planning your life, or having a cohesive idea of what you're doing, isn't necessarily ambition. It's more just a soothing notion. Focus instead on what you want to do with each and every day of your existence. That's noble. That's worthwhile. That will get you somewhere. 7. You owe nothing to your younger self. You are not responsible for being the person you once thought you'd be. 8. You owe everything to the adult you are today. You owe it to yourself to ask yourself what you like, what you want, what calls you, what you need, and what you deserve. 9. Do you know why you don't have the things you once thought you wanted? Because you don't want them anymore. Not badly enough. 10. It's likely that you're between realizing you don't want what you once did and giving yourself permission to want what you want now. 11. Give yourself permission to want what you want now. 12. If you want to change your life, stop thinking about how you feel lost and start coming up with actions you can take that move you in a direction, any direction, that's positive. It's a lot harder to think your way into a new way of acting than it is to act your way into a new way of thinking. 13. Nobody's life is as good as it looks online. 14. Nobody cares about your social media presence as much as you do. 15. Social media has uniquely and distinctly made us ever more concerned with the next big goal. If you feel like you don't know where your life is going, it's likely because you don't know what you want your next big impressive goal to be. 16. You don't need to accomplish anything to be a worthwhile human being. Very few people are actually meant to be extraordinary. That does not mean you cannot know contentment, love, joy, and all the real wonders of life. 17. Your life is only ever as good as your perception of it is. Feeling lost or like you don't know what you're doing is only solved by learning to think about things differently. That's all. 18. Stop asking, what am I doing with my life? And start asking, what am I doing with today? 72. The art of awareness, or how to not completely hate yourself. All hatred is self-hatred, and everything is feedback. I really hope you remember those two tiny sentences every time your chest is pretzeled up and you feel hopeless and helpless, and as though you're spiraling into a bottomless bucket of shit. Everything is a reflection of you, because all anything can ever be is what you take from it, and all you can ever take from it, and all you will ever take from it, is what you are aware enough to perceive. The expanse of your experience is directly in line with your consciousness. Nothing is as it is. It is as you are. That's a play on an Aeneas Nin quote. Unless you are there to touch and smell and see a flower, it is nothing but random matter vibrating in a void. Your recognition gives it its beauty and its presence. You are not in the world. The world is in you. And though that sounds like another abstract platitude, it is not. it is reflective of a greater, deeper, truer truth. And in these tiny moments of recognition, of awareness, we find that what we immediately perceive is not all there is, and that anything that feels dense and heavy and wrong and negative is not a matter of what's going on outside, but what we're not healing and changing inside. Awareness is the antidote to solving so many seemingly unsolvable problems. Just the simple knowing that your egocentric mind is deriving other people's actions and assuming other people's thoughts to torture you is enough to silence it. The art of learning to be is unassigning good and bad and right and wrong to what you feel and what you see and what other people show you. After all, even the heaviest, darkest things ultimately serve you and open you to a truth you wouldn't have considered before had you not been put in the context to see it. Here, all the things to consider and reflect on and read over again when you're feeling particularly terrible. It was requested numerous times that I write a follow-up to this, so here you go. 1. Your actions are more powerful than what anybody can ever say of you. The thing about spiraling downward into a fit of helplessness is that it's usually accompanied by the feeling that we are completely out of control of how other people see us. Of course, this is nothing more than a mechanism of how we see ourselves, but bear with me, because the point here is that not one word anybody says is more powerful or true than how you behave and who you really are. You hold the power here. You call the shots. How other people want to perceive you is their problem, which they will have to come to terms with eventually. How much you want to allow their perceptions to affect you is yours. 2. What you think others think is more important than what they actually think. It shows you to yourself. Once you gain the awareness that the whole concept of what other people think is one grand illusion that you're always at the short end of, you start to realize that how other people see you shifts as your mindset does. Funny how that works, huh? 3. Your reactions matter more than other people's actions do, and you can choose how you react. Your opinions, thoughts, feelings, emotions, mental states do not have to rest on what you find out or simply imagine people do or don't say, slash think or believe about you. The reality of it is, you will never know the entirety of what people are saying or thinking or believing, and those things are none of your business. They are carrying on, and always have been, whether or not you're made aware of it. The only thing that changes here is how much you want to change yourself based on that hypothetical. They can say what they want. You can react how you want. 4. In terms of romantic relationships and sex and love and body types and attraction and all that, the people worth loving and dating and sleeping with are far more accepting than you're giving them credit for. There was never a true love story in the history of ever that blossomed because somebody thought somebody else's abs were flawless. As long as you're seeking validation from somebody who is inherently never going to give it, is as long as you're withholding yourself from someone who will love you regardless. 5. You're supposed to be embarrassed of your younger self. Really. It's a mark of progress. It doesn't mean you have to stay embarrassed, though. It's good because it means you're able to look back and wonder, how was I ever at that place? Indicating that you're no longer there. I hope you never reach a point in which you look back on your younger self and think, wow, I had it all figured out. That means you stopped growing. And that means you stopped living. 6. There are overarching problems, and then there are the symptoms of those problems that crop up again and again. Most people spend their whole lives only addressing the latter. For example, losing weight isn't going to fix your body image problem, no matter how much you convince yourself you're doing the right thing. You're doing what will make you fit into your perception of correct, as opposed to realizing that genuine body love doesn't have your mental stability hinging on whether or not you miss a class or eat a piece of pizza. It is a matter of evaluating not how the actions look on the surface, but where they are rooted. I'm not saying addressing those roots is easy or finding them fun. I'm saying you'll have to do it eventually. You can choose to now, or you will be forced to later. 7. There is no fear or worry or concern or paranoia or insecurity that you could possibly muster up that 1,000,005 other humans haven't already felt. The thing about self-loathing is that it's isolating in nature. It makes you the other, and everybody else the judgy normal people. I know this may be a little disheartening for your ego, but take it in stride. Generally speaking, and acknowledging logical exceptions, there is nothing you've ever done that hasn't been done before, somewhere, somehow, at some time. The story of the human condition is universal in nature. It's the separation and thought that we're the only ones experiencing it that intensifies the suffering element of that. Interesting how that works, right? 8. At any given time, you're mostly just concerned with how one or maybe two people perceive you. Those people also tend to be the ones who we feel unaccepted by in one way or another. We're trying to prove something. We're worried about who will see us in an unflattering way and report it back to them. They're usually the almost relationships, slightly disapproving parents, certain someones who we've dreamt of impressing for years on end. We're incapable of having our lives revolve around more than a few people at a time, even if it seems like we're worried about people as a whole. Try to put a face to that worry every time one crops up, and you'll find that the faceless crowd of people is really just one or two who are very, very familiar to you. 9. Nobody's thinking about you as much as you are thinking about you. So much of our internal conversations with ourselves revolve around quelling fear and panic about how we're being perceived at any given time. What we seldom realize is that the X factor here is that we're thinking through other people's mindsets. We're just making predictions and assumptions which are heavily, if not entirely, influenced by our own assumptions of ourselves. To put it shortly, everybody else is running around worrying about themselves as much as you are worrying about yourself. 10. There's too much at stake. To waste your time on worrying about things that are impermanent, unimportant, and ultimately just distractions from the things that bring you joy. 11. Your feelings of panic are directly related to wanting to change yourself to fit someone else's idea of who you are. If you didn't care to please someone else, if you didn't feel you needed to be okay with them to be okay, you wouldn't be worried about it. That sense of panic and concern with how they see you at all is directly, albeit not entirely, related to how much you feel you need to change or prove yourself otherwise. On a deeper level, it means you've externalized your sense of worth and purpose, and therefore stability, and so long as it remains that way, it can never be genuine. 12. So if you want to get over these external, surface-level, shallow things, you have to turn your attention to things that matter more. This is the truest solution and most effective antidote and secret of all secrets to renouncing your sense of whether or not you're going to be okay with yourself. Make something matter more than how other people see you. If all you have to care about, if all you think you can offer the world is a nice body or a fancy lifestyle or a lot of money or approval that makes you feel good, you're not doing everything you can and should be. Of course you're going to run into anxiety. It's all meaningless. The moment you know you're worth more than how you're seen, the moment you genuinely take stock in the notion that your life is more important than you, is the moment that everybody else's petty concerns fall to the wayside into the oblivion of unimportance. You become blind to them because you're only focused on what really does matter. You, and whatever the hell you have to genuinely offer to the world. 73. 10 questions to ask yourself when you don't know where your life should go next. 1. If you had the life you think you want, what would tomorrow be like? When you imagine the life you want, rather than focus on the elevator speech, I am this, I do this, focus on the daily routine. If you had the life you think you want, what would you do tomorrow? How different would it be from what you're doing now? What from that vision can you actually start doing tomorrow? 2. If social media didn't exist, what would you do differently? Would you dress differently? Feel bad about where you live? Care about what your apartment looks like? What choices would you make if you didn't feel they were being silently policed by the faceless mob of people that lie behind the screens of social media? What would matter? What would you do? Who would you be? 3. If nobody would know what you did with the rest of your life, what would you do? If your life wasn't the slightest bit performative, if there was nothing you could get from doing something other than just the act of doing it, how would you spend your time? What would you be interested in doing? What would energize you? 4. If you died yesterday, what would you most regret? Forget imagining if you died tomorrow. What if you were already dead? What would you regret the most? What would you wish you had done differently, saw differently, responded to differently? 5. If you could choose 5 things that matter most to you, what would they be? Whether you realize it or not, your life will fundamentally be built off of the few things you care about the most. When it's not, it will feel out of alignment at best, or off the rails at worst. Fulfillment is living in accordance with what we genuinely value. 6. To what in your life do you feel a subtle, unexplainable nudge? What gives you a feeling of subtle, unexplainable enjoyment? What do you like, even though you don't understand why you like it? These are the things to pay attention to. These are the things that are real. Your mind is responding to what you think you like. Your emotions are responding to what actually resonates. 7. If you knew nobody would judge you, what would you do with your days? If you would only be praised for your work, for your life, and for your choices, which would you make? What would you do? 8. What are you struggling with the most right now? Interestingly enough, the things that plague you the most deeply are signals toward where you must move next. If your deepest issue is not having a romantic relationship, the next phase of your life will likely need to involve at least trying to develop that. The things that you're struggling with the most right now can tell you what you really want and toward which direction you should step. 9. What do you already have going for you at this present moment? The mantra of any major life change should always be, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. There is no other way to get anywhere. 10. If you had to live tomorrow on repeat for the rest of your life, what would you do? Or put another way, if you lived today on repeat forever, where would you be? What would you have accomplished? Would you be thriving at work? Would you have made time for the people you love? Would you have written a book or played music or be spending your money in a healthy way? Would you be dressing like yourself and enjoying the sunrise and eating in a way that will sustain you over the long term? Your life exists in its days, not in your ideas about those days. Your habits accumulate and begin to default. Imagine that you'll never grow out of them is the fastest way to a reality check. 74. There's no such thing as letting go. There's just accepting what's already gone. All things are good. All things are ultimately designed to serve us. All things are good. I know what you're thinking. What the hell? That sounds like just another nonsensical platitude that you're trying to pass off as a truth that cannot possibly be true. But what is it that makes something bad? It's what we've decided, or have been conditioned to believe isn't right. What makes a feeling bad? We have lots of feelings. Why are some good and some bad? Some show us that we're on the right path, and some show us how and when and where we need to redirect. How is the former better than the latter? Isn't the latter actually more important? Bad feelings become bad when we fight them. When instead of listening to ourselves, instead of permitting whatever feelings are going to transpire, even if they aren't necessarily comfortable, we fight them. The things that are meant to serve us and show us the parts of ourselves that need to be healed, or the places in our paths where we need to take a turn, become bad. In the grand scheme of it all, good and bad are value assignments, and they're subjective. To a person, to a family, to a culture, to a country, to a nation, to a race, etc. What's right to one is wrong to another. What's good for someone is tragic for someone else. History isn't taught the same way in classrooms around the world. The second you realize you can define what good is in your life is the second you can start to free yourself. Because everything, even the hardest things to get over, can be good, if we choose to see why they're present, what they need to show us. It's a rare thing to love somebody unconditionally. The very basis of love is finding someone who fills a set of preconceived conditions. When the object of our affection doesn't abide by them as we once thought they would, our feelings begin to falter. That's why the deepest relationships become the hardest. Someone fills an idea of what you wanted and needed, and then as soon as they don't, you're absolutely taken aback. You aren't doing what I think you were supposed to be doing, therefore, how could you do this to me? This isn't actually loving someone. And the key to getting over that kind of half-assed love is realizing that much of what we fight and fall apart over isn't a matter of whether or not we love someone as a being, as a person, as a presence in our lives, but how much we do or don't approve of what they do for us. We're finicky that way. We say we want unconditional love and happiness, but we don't behave as though we do. We want love and happiness when we get someone or something. Why? Because it puts the responsibility of choosing happiness, working on it and toward it, on something else. The first step in regaining your locus of control, your embodiment of self, is to permit all things. Allow the love. Allow the loss. Allow the ebb and flow. Don't harbor intention. Just be. How quickly do even our deepest troubles fade away when we center ourselves on this? In the Tao, it says that softness is the equivalent of life. Bodies stiffen in death. Trees that harden are cut down. Therefore, hardness is death, and softness is life. When our hearts harden, when parts of us are blocked and filled with unfiltered emotions, we're forced to break them. The trees are chopped. The bodies decay. Hardness can only exist for a time. The brain has a mechanism where it focuses on the most severe pain and blocks out all the others. It focuses on the hardest part and forces us to face it, even though it feels like we're dulling all the other pains by focusing and concentrating on one, we're not. We're just furthering ourselves on the path of openness. There is no such thing as letting go. There's just accepting what's already gone. There's losing ourselves in the labyrinth of the illusion of control and finding joy in the chaos, even when it's uncomfortable. It's not forever. It only remains as long as we hold on, as long as we fight, as long as we control, as long as we don't accept what's already gone. 75. You are a book of stories, not a novel. Who you were doesn't have to bleed into who you will be. We often stunt ourselves by tying who we were into who we think we need to become. We can't map a trajectory for our futures without considering what would make sense for the people we used to be. Realizing this was tying together three habits I've picked up about myself, and about people in general. First, we make problems where there are none. As though for our lives to have meaning, we need to overcome something. Happiness is something that we have to consciously choose. Otherwise, we'd create the reality that we subconsciously think we deserve. Not because we assume that who we are deserves it, but because somewhere along the line, we were conditioned by other people, and our own assumptions, to believe that we are only as good as the things they said about us. Second, we avoid things that are too perfect. We destroy them, mentally or otherwise, if they are. Third, we summarize in our heads. Whenever we're about to make a choice, about anything really, we say in our heads what that will sound like. She graduated and started this job at 20, or however it goes. It's as though our decisions can only be acceptable if they sound right, and how they will continue sounding years down the line, whether or not they are right for who we are in that moment. But the synopses we spend so much time writing are for characters we no longer are. You cannot always draw lines between what was and what is and what should thenceforth be. You cannot always make sense of your coexisting truths. You can only know that they are both valid. And you cannot avoid good things because somewhere along the line, the character schematic you outlined for yourself doesn't believe it deserves what you have. When we avoid, when we evade, we cap off our happiness. You weren't meant to be a story that plays out in a nostalgically pleasing way. Life isn't a sepia-toned flashback. Life is vivid and changing and real and unpredictable, unchartable, with no plot other than the one we're living in the moment, here and now. We don't even realize how often we choose our current experiences based on old beliefs we are still subconsciously holding of ourselves. Because what we think of ourselves translates into what we allow of ourselves. And what we allow is what we experience. And what we experience is what amounts to our lives as a whole. A whole of which is a book of stories that don't need to seamlessly transition into one another, which don't have to be narrated the same way, which can be as short or long or staggered or confusing or exciting as you want. The point is that you are in control of how it plays out, but the recurring inner narrative, the little voice that's telling you the story of your life, has to let go of the old chapters to genuinely write the new ones. 76. Everyday signs the world is experiencing a shift in consciousness. There's a social theory that mankind's development is not a linear progression, but rather it occurs in cycles. Civilizations rise and then fall. Collective intelligence peaks higher each time it does. A brief mental sweep of history and a general understanding of nature would make this seem logical enough. We evolve spectacularly, and then catastrophe strikes. It didn't come from nowhere. It's an ancient belief that Earth is subject to its position on its precession of the equinox. Each time it reaches the closest point to the center of the universe, where the concentration of energy is highest, we inch closer to awakening. We are currently on the upswing. Regardless of the mythology, there's something interesting happening in the world today. Our collective consciousness is expanding. We're more aware of what's going on, for better and for worse. We're striving to understand ourselves. We're learning to work with our emotions and build lives that represent what we value, not what we're obligated to. Whatever the cause, here are some of the everyday effects. 1. People are beginning to recognize their power. Self-empowerment, individuality, and autonomy are seen as fundamental to living a whole and fulfilling life. 2. Positive psychology, emotional intelligence, personality typing, and other concepts for self-understanding are becoming increasingly popular. Positive psychology has been having a media heyday over the past 15 years. And between the Big Five, Myers-Briggs, astrology, Enneagrams, and the like, we are starving for self-awareness. And this is how it's presenting itself. 3. Social justice issues are making headlines like never before, and ignorance is being defined as anyone who doesn't consider all beings to be equal. Certainly, this is not the first time in history we've wanted to liberate ourselves from oppressive constructs, but with the help of technology, it is the first time that we think of healthy social norms as being those that are equal and accepting. 4. Yoga and meditation have become common practices in the West. Whereas just a few decades ago, we would have seen these things as strange. Yoga classes are available almost everywhere, and research is showing that meditation actually changes the brain. 5. Common knowledge is expanding at a rate untouched before the internet. Whereas we once only knew as much as we could remember, now we can research virtually anything. Mainstream media has us consuming articles and ideas at record speeds. We're learning in ways we never could before, and faster than we ever could either. 6. There's a newfound interest in organic foods and homeopathic remedies. People are suddenly concerned about GMOs, antibiotics, and the other plethora of chemicals our foods are being drenched in. 7. Everyone can have a voice. Whereas the only messages that were communicated through media were once curated by a select few gatekeepers, now everybody can speak and share their perspective, for better and for worse. Everybody can share what they think, and while it may seem frustrating at times, it is crucial in recognizing where we are collectively. 8. People are questioning the system and learning to think for themselves. While some conversations are more constructive than others, we're theorizing more than we're accepting things as truth. We are becoming ever more skeptical of major social structures, and with good reason. 9. We're basing relationships on compatibility, not obligation. Gone are the days of marrying and parenting because you're supposed to. Now we want compatible life partners, deliberate childbearing, and happy non-nuclear family structures. 10. We're talking about issues that have otherwise gone ignored, depression, sexual abuse, etc., publicly and honestly. We're slowly removing the shame and stigma around mental illness and abuse, and becoming more understanding of those who need help by sharing, relating, teaching, and healing with them. 11. We've just about had it with the employment model as it stands. We recognize that working ourselves to death does not make for a good life. Yet we also realize that we are essentially enslaved to capitalism for our survival. While part-time work and freelancing and work-life balance are becoming more popular topics of conversation, the overarching structure still stands. 12. People are becoming more intuitive, as well as empathetic and curious and informed and tolerant of those who are different from them. 13. We're recognizing the imbalance of feminine energy. We're seeing how deliberately femininity has been oppressed in society, and the crucial importance the lost balance serves us in every aspect of life and society. 14. We're breaking out of the gender binary. We're no longer defining ourselves simply by what we appear to be. It's becoming increasingly more acceptable to discover who you identify as being, rather than just accepting who you seem to be on the outside. 15. We're becoming more concerned with the effect we're having on natural climates. We treat the earth as a thing, not an actual living entity. 16. We're dealing with the effects of long-suppressed emotions. Over the past 5 or so years, you've likely been a friend or family member of someone who has gone through radical, intense changes in their life and in their person, if you didn't do so yourself. It wasn't that we came upon hard times and got through it. We came upon hard times and awakened to something deeper. 77. Why do we value our suffering so much? Suffering is a necessary evil. But its inevitability is not the result of it being something that we naturally have to process out of due course. It's not something we take a passive role in. It is a result of a lack of our own growth. It is a catalyst to signal to us there's more to be done. This is to say, we're in control of it. We cultivate and experience it because we allow it. Rather, we allow the unhealed parts of us to control everything else. If we remain unconscious of this, and that its origin and therefore solution is external, we start to believe that we deserve it. Any one of us can recall instances in which we've unnecessarily ruined a day that was otherwise going well, with a flurry of worry and ungrounded paranoia. We start forcing ourselves to panic, almost out of necessity. If there's nothing, fill it with something. Something we deserve. Where does that assumption come from, though? It usually has a lot to do with repressed emotions. We accumulate these feelings that we don't accept or deal with, and they become the foundation on which we accumulate our beliefs about ourselves. As long as we attach ourselves to an idea of what's wrong, and then allow ourselves to be conditioned by it, a friend lashing out is an outer projection of what they're dealing with. A failed opportunity usually makes way for a better suited one. We become conditioned by the idea that we're not good enough. The key is realizing that we do this to ourselves. We live trapped in the mental structures that we allowed external circumstances to construct because we never realized we could dismantle them. As soon as we're in a situation that activates one of these memories, taps into an unhealed, unresolved issue, we don't stop to see it objectively. We lash out at what aggravated the problem. Our pain can't dictate our internal dialogue, and we can't let ourselves run with compulsive, involuntary thoughts. Every time we do this, we allow that emotion to infiltrate our awareness and transmute itself into our current experience. We project what was onto what is. There's an element of disidentification that has to happen. The realization that what's being experienced isn't a matter of what's at hand, but just a subjective, temporary projection of whatever it is you currently believe, in this case, that you should suffer. Ironically, though, the opposite of pain isn't joy. It's acceptance. Resisting only adds more fuel to the fire. It sets you back to where you were when you initially repressed it. It's not dismantling the structure. It's strengthening it. You permit it by fighting it. It's hard for us to believe we deserve happiness, and so we continually go out of our way to attract and inflict pain. That dichotomy is natural, and it's human, but there's something to be said for transcending it. If you want to think it's impossible, you'll only continue to suffer because of it. If you want to keep valuing that suffering as something that makes you more human, then so be it. But the reality is that what makes us human is not what destroys us, but what we build ourselves with again. As Marcus Aurelius has said, choose not to be harmed, and you won't feel harmed. Don't feel harmed, and you haven't been. 78. What you find in solitude. Loneliness is just an idea. It is the implication that you are ever disconnected from those around you. It's what happens when you depend on interaction to understand and be okay with yourself. Because interaction has less to do with how other people treat you and more to do with how you perceive yourself based on that treatment. It's not about how many people are actually around us or giving us love. It's what that love means to us and how it alters our mindset toward whatever it is we're doing or focusing on. Companionship seems like the reinforcement of oneness and connectivity. But it is also the idea that you not only need someone else's presence, but their approval, their acceptance. You can be more alone in a crowded room and feel more connected in complete solitude. To the extent that we are separate beings, or to the extent that we are aware that we are separate beings, is how lonely we can ever be. Essentially, you are only as alone as you think you are. Getting past that idea that aloneness is lonely is chiefly important, because there's something phenomenally foreign and elusive that you find in that kind of sacred idleness. When you stop working and start being. When you stop defining yourself by the roles you play for other people and for yourself. You stop seeing yourself within the context of a society. You stop judging yourself by comparison. You start diffusing your mindset of thinking through what would be acceptable to others. You don't just start to hear yourself talk, but you realize that you are a person hearing a mind. And you begin to communicate with yourself in ways that are so much deeper, more fathomable, more understandable than language can ever permit. As Huxley again once said, in spite of language, in spite of intelligence and intuition and sympathy, one can never really communicate anything to anybody. The essential substance of every thought and feeling remains incommunicable, locked up in the impenetrable strong room of the individual soul and body. Our life is a sentence of perpetual solitary confinement. This is not a bad thing, though. It shows you who you are, because you're no longer being someone else to someone else. You are only to yourself. You stop behaving to fit a standard and start acting for the sake of survival, of being alive, of humanness. You don't realize how much of your daily life, how many of your rote actions are contrived solely by the means of being acceptable to the world around you, and how much these actions that are not founded in genuineness can disconnect you from yourself. Solitude is the most important practice of all. It grounds you in what is and helps you escape from what you think should be. It is both infuriating and freeing for just that reason. It leaves you alone to see who you are and what you do. More importantly, it leaves you alone to see the real essence of what it is to be a person, the good, the bad, the downright odd and ugly. It leaves you no choice but to contemplate the bigger picture, the underlying reason, the way things are. The only time we see the whole structure clearly is when we step away from it. 79. How to raise a generation of kids who don't have a problem with anxiety. Most people don't think they're obsessed with controlling their emotions because they aren't consciously thinking about their feelings. Instead, they are thinking about everything else that needs to be right so that they don't have to feel at all. They imagine their worst nightmares to life. They worry incessantly about how much money they have to make to be successful, how much food they must constrict to maintain their size, the minutia of how other people respond to them so that they may behave in a way that makes them likable. They think about their social media presence, whether or not something is right for them, how nice their home appears to be. They use fear to police themselves into being good. We don't think of these things as emotional control because they are the physical or mental parts of our lives. Yet we don't control the physical things in our lives when we can't control our emotions. We control the physical things in our lives to control our emotions. We think that if we find a soulmate, we can't get heartbroken. If we're attractive, we'll be respected. If other people think of us fondly, we'll always think of ourselves that way too. As anyone who struggles with heightened or irrational emotions can tell you, the root of most anxiety and panic is a fear of experiencing anxiety and panic. We deny our feelings not by refusing to feel them, but by using other things to try to avoid them. When we are obsessed with trying to control outcomes and reduce risks and ensure that we do not experience anything bad, we are not living whole lives. We are fragmented selves, expressing only the parts we are momentarily comfortable with. This emotional disassociation begins in childhood as a product of being punished for bad feelings. Children do not know how to self-regulate their emotions. They don't understand them, and like the way they don't understand how their bodies work, or what it means to have manners at the dinner table, or treat others with respect, they must be taught. Yet very often they are not. Instead, kids are taught that acting out will get them punished, and so begins the cycle of suppression. They learn that their parents will love them more when they are good. They shut down the parts of themselves they fear are unacceptable. What they are responding to is a lack of feeling loved. What they are wired to chase is their parents' love. If it is not being given naturally, they will try to manipulate how the parent sees them so it is created. Unfortunately, in this process, they disassociate from a crucial part of themselves. And this is how they evolve into panicked, judgmental, anxious adults who cannot function in relationships. This is how they learn that it's crucial to control everything around them. If they don't trigger a feeling, they don't have to deal with it. The way we raise adults who don't struggle with anxiety is by being adults who accept anxiety. We must be the voice of reason that they do not have yet. The voices they hear from us, especially in their most fearful and vulnerable moments, will become the voices in their head someday. The way we raise adults who don't struggle with anxiety is by being adults who are loving and kind and non-judgmental. Kids do not do what we tell them. They do what we do. If we want the world to change, we have to change ourselves. If we want to inspire them to cope with their feelings, we must learn to cope with our own. And right now, we have the very unique privilege of learning how. Without the emotional intelligence to cope with anxiety, we have the opportunity to consciously grow to understand it. We have the potential to give our kids and their kids, and the kids after that, the gift of self-knowledge. But it can only come from giving it to ourselves first. Ain't that how it always goes? 80. The Idiot's Guide to Emotional Intelligence. Why We Need Pain. Pleasure cannot cure pain. This is one of the largest psychological misconceptions out there. Pleasure cannot cure pain because they exist on opposite ends of the same spectrum. Biologically, both our pleasure and pain responses are headquartered in the same part of the brain. The pleasure chemical that brings us joy is involved in the pain response as well. Alan Watts says that is the price we pay for increasing our consciousness. Simply, we cannot be more sensitive to one emotion and not also then experience the others to the same degree. You know how people say that if you didn't have rainy days, you wouldn't be able to appreciate the sunny ones? The truth is that if you didn't have rainy days, the sunny ones wouldn't exist. This is called duality. We live in duality. We exist because of duality. That sounds like a buzzword, but this is a very important thing to understand. Our bodies exist in duality. Our lungs, hearts, gonads, they all function because they have an opposite and equal half. The same is true of nature. It sustains itself through a cycle of creation and destruction, as does human life. It's important to understand that we are not separate from the anatomy of the universe. There is no good without bad, high without low, or life without pain. The problem is not the presence of pain. It's the inability to see the purpose of it. We believe that happiness is the sustained state of feeling good. It is because of this belief that we are not happy. Happy people are not people who feel good all the time. They are the people who are able to be guided by their negative emotions, rather than paralyzed by them. Happiness is not about how good you feel, but why you feel it. A life built on meaning and purpose feels good, though so does a life built on greed and selfishness, yet one is better than the other. Why? Greed and selfishness are quintessential traits of someone seeking a high to eliminate pain. Meaning and purpose, driven work or ideologies are traits of people who have accepted their pain and have chosen to work with, not against it. The former is destructive and unfulfilling. The latter is more difficult, but worthwhile. Our pain serves us. It is a crucial guiding force. Suffering begins to thrive when we don't listen to it. Imagine what happens when you place your hand on a burning stove. You feel pain because your body is signaling for you to move your hand before it disintegrates. Our emotional lives are no different, except for the fact that we understand the consequence of keeping our hand on the stove. We do not yet understand the consequence of what our emotional pain is guiding us from. We see pain as being in opposition to our well-being, rather than a key component in creating it. The first thing that's required to fix this is understanding that we don't inherently want to avoid pain. In fact, a lot of what we think we want is not what we want at all. Some of the most emotionally empty and unfulfilled people are those we idolize for being rich or successful. Next, it's shifting our goals from wanting to transcend the pain to aiming for a more neutral emotional pH. Some call this shifting the baseline. We usually avoid the actual work of adjusting our mental/emotional receptivity because doing so eliminates the possibility of attaining the external high. We think we're giving up on the dreams and hopes we assumed would make us feel incredible. In reality, what we are giving up is simply the illusion that those things will bring sustained happiness in favor of a shift in perception, which actually will. In the absolute simplest terms possible, we call this peace. When neither the desire for a high or the suppression of the low is present, when you've shifted your baseline from survive to thrive, and have detached from outcomes, you can enjoy what each day brings. Once you step out from the endless race of chasing elusive happiness, you realize that you were never running towards something better. You were just trying to outrun yourself. You will also realize that it was only because of pain that you were able to understand this. Your pain lined the pathway. It was guiding you to that understanding all along. 81. Every relationship you have is with yourself. It's interesting enough that human beings are the only known species that have relationships with themselves. But it's even more to consider the fact that human beings are the only species that have relationships with themselves through other people. That is, our perceptions of other people's mindsets largely dictate how we see ourselves. What binds us in love, in companionship, in friendship? Familiarity. The sense that you understand each other at a visceral level. It's just being able to see yourself in someone else, and more importantly, being able to change your inner narrative when you know, see and feel that someone else loves and accepts and approves of you no matter what. Ergo, you can do the same. It's a survival mechanism, I'm pretty sure. The most meaningful relationships tend to be the ones in which we're completely reflected back to ourselves, because this is what relationships serve to do, open us. We only recognize this in the big, overwhelming, usually heart-wrenching ones, but it's true of every relationship. And it's the crux of our issues beyond basic survival. How we are in relation to other people. how we are in relation to ourselves. The relationships we tend to be most happy in are the ones in which we adopt that other person's supposed narrative, what we think they think of us. We feel most loved when we feel understood, when we are thinking that someone else is thinking in alignment with what we need to hear and believe. We feel most loved when we think someone thinks highly of us, their efforts and displays of affection serving to prove this. This is why not just anybody can affirm for us that we're okay, only people to whom we've placed meaning, someone to whom we already feel a physical or psychological connection, someone we are looking at as a partner for ourselves, someone who is like us, someone who understands us. It's why loving yourself first is the most common, the most confusing, and yet the most profoundly solid advice anyone can give. Because it's not really about feeling love for yourself. It's being able to feel stable enough that your mindset doesn't rest in the narrative of a supposed others. This is why things hurt so badly when we identify with them. All hatred is self-hatred. This is why we become so goddamned heartbroken. We cannot lose people. We can only lose ourselves in an idea of them. We decided how we felt about ourselves through them, for better and for worse. So when we perceive that their mindset changes from loving us to loving someone else, our own stability goes out the window too. The most freeing, liberating thing you can do is to realize that we are all a collective one, and that each fragment of a bigger light refracts on one another in just a way that reveals what you need to see and understand, but that the light is always your own. Every relationship you have is with yourself. Every person in whom you feel you return home to is just coming back to yourself. It's always yourself you find at the end of the journey. The sooner you face you, the less you need other people to fill voids. You cannot squeeze someone into your brokenness and expect them to make you whole. The sooner you face you, the sooner other people's actions don't affect you negatively. Your mindset doesn't depend on them. You don't depend on them. Relationships do not serve to give you eternal, perpetual happiness. They serve to make you more aware. The sooner you realize that said awareness is your own, the easier everything else is. 82. 15 little ways to deepen your relationship with anyone. 1. Spend a Sunday with them. Not a Saturday night when everything is bustling and loud and socially seamless. Spend a Sunday morning with them, tired and hungover and without plans for the day. Eat breakfast together and don't fix your hair. Experience each other without needing to entertain. 2. Be comfortably silent. Go for a long drive and allow for bouts of quietness as they naturally happen. Existing in someone's silence is existing in the most intimate part of their life. 3. Call them when you're not okay. Take them up on the promise to be there for you no matter what. Tell them the truth. Let them comfort and console you. Tell them that you're there for them if they ever need it. Hold true to that promise. 4. Hold space for them. Listen to what they have to say wholly, without anticipating your response, without checking your phone, without wandering eyes. Give them the entirety of your energy. There is nothing more precious and sacred and rare. 5. Talk about ideas. What you believe in, what you theorize about existence, or what fate could have in store for you in the next 5 years. just move beyond discussing people and events and petty daily grievances. 6. Read each other's favorite books. Trade your personal copies, the ones that are highlighted and marked up, where the binding is almost completely breaking loose from having been flipped through so many times.